Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and other musicians, uncover their life stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, then stick around. You're in the right place. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. It's an honor and a privilege to have my guest today. I've wanted to have Mac McAnally on for a long time. Had to go through lots of people, lots of red tape, but we finally got him on here. And he's got a new record out. It's a beautiful record in addition to everything else he's put out there, man. And I'm really happy he's here. Couple of quick announcements. Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Subscribe to the show. And if you're watching us on YouTube, click the subscribe button and the bell icon. I would appreciate that. All right. Tell you about Mac if you haven't heard about him. And if you haven't, or if you have or you haven't, you need to listen to his new record and just go back to his old stuff. He's an incredibly talented guy. His voice, man, I thought his singing voice was great. And then he got on here like 3 seconds into it, man. I got goosebumps from his speaking voice. So,
how about that?
And he's super humble. This is the most humble guy you'll meet. Anyway, Mac McAnally, singer, songwriter, session musician, and record producer, closely affiliated with the Muscle Shoals scene. He's been inducted into the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame. He's won Musician of the Year for the CMA 10 times. And he just released his 15th record called Once in a Lifetime. He's written or co-written several number one Billboard country hits by folks like Kenny Chesney, Alabama, Sawyer Brown, and Shenandoah, and close to 20 other very successful hit songs. As a sideman, he's played on hundreds of records, including artists like Kenny Chesney, Joan Baez, Roy Orbison, George Jones, Levon Helm, Nancy Griffith, Marty Stewart, Reba McEntire, Keith Whitley. Did you play with Jeff King on those sessions?
Yes, I did, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. he's a great guy. He's a
hilarious double neighbor. We're neighbors in Nashville and Muscle Shoals.
Oh, are you? That's cool, man. I spent a lot of time with you. He's a great guy. Keith Whitley, Ricky Skaggs, Steve Warner, who we had here on the show, Vince Gill, Hank Williams, Billy Joel, Amy Grant, Toby Keith, and like dozens and dozens and dozens of other people. He's produced records by Restless Heart and others and is a longtime member of Jimmy Buffett's backing band, the Coral Reefer Band. I think reefer might be the key word there. If you're new to Mac, he's a great singer and guitarist. He's a really tasty. I mean, he's just a total professional, man. This is a guy you listen to and it's like, wow, this guy just has it all together. But he's a beautiful songwriter, lyrically and musically, and that's really hard to find, that combination. Thank you, man. I appreciate you coming on the show.
I appreciate it. I don't know if I can live up to your intro, but it sure was fun to listen to. Thank you.
Somebody will live up to it. So Wikipedia said you started playing piano and singing in church in Belmont, Mississippi, and that you started writing songs shortly after that. If you could take me back, Mac, to that time frame and maybe tell me how you got started performing in church and what was so rewarding for you about what you were doing.
Well, I came out of a musical family to a certain degree. My mom was a gospel piano player. I mean, that wasn't her day job. She, as far as I know, she never charged anybody a penny to play music, but she played all the time. She played services on Sunday and played the all day singings that the Baptists in Mississippi are known for, and Wednesday night services. And she played weddings and funerals all her life and never charged anybody a penny. But, she also was our entertainment at home. We were one of the last families in Belmont to get a television. So our entertainment was pretty much my mom would sit and play, and our neighbors would come over and bring various instruments that didn't necessarily fit together. I mean, we might have a dulcimer and a soprano sax going in the same room and basically playing gospel music. And that's how we entertained ourselves. Two or three nights a week, that was going on in my house. So I was just kind of sandblasted with music from the time I hit the ground, and my family always felt like I had musical talent, and I don't know that I did, or if they just convinced me that I did somewhere along the way, but because music was always going, and I was hanging with my mom, I would, you know, as a kid, they would stand me up on the piano bench and I would sing with my mom and get, you know, accolade to a certain degree. People would brag on a little red-headed kid that could sing a little bit. And it came from that. And I'm not, honestly, I'm not the tenth of the piano player that my mom was, but my hometown had like an 8 o'clock curfew and we didn't lock the doors of church. So I used to love the way our church sounded. And I would go in there after hours, after curfew, when I was not supposed to be out, into our empty church and play the piano. And that's where songwriting started for me, was in an empty church with the illusion that I sounded kind of good because, you know, you get that sort of auditorium sound around your voice or your instrument or whatever you're playing. The first songs that I wrote literally just fell out of my mouth in the time that they take to sing. My first couple of songs, I just played a D minor chord and sang it like I'd known it all my life. And I said, that must be how people write songs. They just fall out of your mouth. And I had two or three happen that way. And you know, and then a year passed and nothing else happened. And I said, well, maybe some people have to work on them, you know, but initially I didn't have the nerve to call it songwriting, but they just fell out of my mouth. And I was grateful for that and associated with some measure of a gift. And it went from there. I played and sang in church up until the time I was 13. And then beginning at 13, I played in state line honky tonks at the Tennessee state line because my hometown was a dry county. Right. So there was no place to play in a band. There was no place for bands to play. And it was also like the movie Footloose. It was illegal to dance in Belmont, Mississippi.
Wow. And
we used to have to go across the state line to have the junior senior prom every year. So they could dance. It was, I mean, it sounds like I'm talking about 100 years ago, but it's not that long ago in North Mississippi. You know,
yeah, well, that's what I'm amazed at because this is our lifetime. You know, it's not that long ago.
It is our lifetime, and it's wonderful people. I'm really happy that's where I grew up. But the physics of the way it worked for me, and I'm probably running past the end of this question. I apologize, but
no, it's perfect, man.
But it, when I was 13. This guy came to our house and knocked on the door, and somebody had told this guy that I was a piano player, and I wasn't really much of a piano player, but his piano player had quit. He was in a band at the state line, Iron City, Tennessee, a club called the Circle E Club. And believe it or not, the name of his band was Dean and the Reefers.
Little did you know, Reefers been following you your whole life.
Not only that, little did he know, because he was a straight laced butch, you know, buzz cut hairdo, and he couldn't stand long hairs or hippies, and he didn't know what reefer meant.
Wow.
Just like the sound of the word, and he had it painted on the side of his vein. And he could never understand why everybody gave us the peace sign when you know, when we drove by. Why do they do that? But at any rate, he came and made a pitch to my parents for me to be his piano player at Iron City, Tennessee. And I'm 13 years old. I'm definitely underage to go in a honky tonk. And I never been anywhere except church. And I'm waiting on my mom and dad to throw him off the porch. But he was persistent and he told him, he said, I know you want your son to be a musician. I know you want him to play with other musicians. You don't have more than one musician at your church. He said, I'm a good Christian man. I'll look after him. I'll come and pick him up and I'll drive him to Iron City, Tennessee. And when we finish at 1 a.m, I'll feed him and bring him back home. And I'll pay him $250 a week.
Wow.
Something in his presentation made an impression on my parents. And that Friday night, I was wearing a lime green hand-me-down leisure suit from George Jones's band and playing at the Circle E Club, songs that I'd never heard in my life, country songs that I honestly had never heard in my life, for $250 a week as a member of Dean and the Reefers. And it rolled from there.
Man, what a great story. That is so cool. Let me ask you this, because I've talked to a lot of people that grew up in the church. And so that was pretty progressive of your parents.
It really was. Because honestly, they had never, neither one of my parents had ever darkened the door of a honky tonk, and were not ever going to. They never did. The whole time I was playing in bars, they never walked in the door of one of them. But they trusted me to behave myself and stay true to your raisin, as they said back in Mississippi, and learn what I could learn about playing in a band with other musicians. And honestly, we played some scary places. I mean, the Circle Club, there were people in the building with live chainsaws that they would rev up instead of applauding at the end of the song. I was afraid to get off stage. It wasn't quite the Blues Brothers and the Chicken Wire.
Yeah.
But that, I would have loved some Chicken Wire, because I got hit by stuff, you know, that the Chicken Wire would have stopped. But I was sitting on the piano, and when we took a break, I was afraid to get off stage. There, I mean, there were knife fights and stuff every night. And so I would carry my acoustic guitar, and on our breaks, I would sit down behind the piano and practice acoustic guitar, because I was just killing time until we played some more. And that's how I met the Muscle Shoals session players, because Muscle Shoals was also a Dry County. For such a music center, it was illegal to buy a beer in Muscle Shoals. And so all of those great players that were playing on all those R&B records and great rock and roll records and country records, if they wanted to play live, they had to go across the Tennessee line too. So we were going through Muscle Shoals 5 nights a week. I was playing 5 nights a week, and then going to the seventh grade, at 8 o'clock every morning. But the session players, I ended up meeting some of the Muscle Shoals rhythm section guys, because I was playing in these honky tonks, and they was like, it's that weird kid that's practicing acoustic guitar on the breaks. And they would come up and listen to me play a little bit, a finger pick, and they'd say, man, you want to come to some of the studios and play in the studios? Because we don't really have an acoustic player. You know, as you know, as everybody knows, there were great guitar players in Muscle Shoals.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Blaine Allman had been there and gone already, but Pete Carr and Eddie Hinton and Tippy Armstrong and Junior Lowe, there was Larry Byron from Steppenwolf was still there in the rhythm sections. But there was no dedicated acoustic player. And so at 15, I started playing in the studios in Muscle Shoals. And because there wasn't really another dedicated acoustic player, I got the privilege of going and playing at the various studios. I could go to Fame. I could go to Wishbone. I could go to Muscle Shoals Sound, Broadway, Widget, East Avalon. I played acoustic at all those studios. And for the most part, Muscle Shoals in those days, you were one of those rhythm sections. You were the Fame guy,
right,
or you were the Muscle Shoals Sound guy. So I actually had, looking back at what a blessing that was, is to see how Rick Hall was making records, and to see how Terry Woodford and Clayton Ivey, where I was sort of part of the rhythm section at Wishbone more than anywhere else, but I got to go play with Roger Hawkins and David Hood and Pete Carr and Jimmy and over at Muscle Shoals Sound, play with everybody at Fame. It was really just, you know, like Alice in Wonderland for me to be able to see Jerry Wexler and how he did it, and Rick Hall the next day how he did it, and just be a sponge and try to pick up record making. As you know, I didn't know anything about what I was doing, but I was in the presence of people who did. And you know, if you can keep your mouth shut long enough, you can pick some stuff up.
That's amazing. So that's so if you like look as, how do you think about this to yourself? Do you think this is like right place, right time, serendipity, act of God, combination?
Yeah, all of that, because I came out of church. But I also, Craig, the way that I was raised, and a wonderful family that I came out of, but we were basically farm displaced farmers. You know, it's hard to make a living farming, yeah. But we had like, you know, 5 acre garden, but,
5 acre.
That's why I have a bad back to this day. My back is terrible from bending over and pulling peanuts and potatoes. But at any rate, coming from that, we were raised that it's not a positive character trait to call attention to yourself, you know, to be humble, to be selfless. And that's still the people I admire the most. My parents, among them, are people who put others before themselves. That's the way I was raised. And that's still what makes an impression on me. But for somebody like that to try to wind up in show business, I was so bashful, and that being my nature, I honestly would never have had the nerve to pack up and go to Music City, even though it's 2.5-3 hours away, and say somebody should listen to me and see if I've got any talent or not. I didn't have that in me. There was not a bone in my body to do that. But because just the physics that I was 40 minutes from Muscle Shoals and I was going through Muscle Shoals 5 days a week, I could go to Muscle Shoals and fail and be back home by supper time. And that's more practical. It was less hypothetical than sitting there saying, oh, I could go to Nashville and maybe make a living. Muscle Shoals was a great, I don't even want to say intermediary place, because it truly is still my musical home. My big studio is still in Muscle Shoals, and I'm a small town guy. So my compass sets to there as a songwriter, as a producer, things that I get to control. I tend to do at least part of the work there just because it feels right to me.
Yeah.
And I love Nashville. I moved to Nashville in 93. I'm not saying anything at all bad about Nashville, but because I'm such a small town guy and I'm sort of superstitious about the process, because I have Muscle Shoals, I feel great in Nashville and LA and New York and Bora Bora, wherever we are is with the Coral Reefers. I'm a confident guy because I know what's in Muscle Shoals. So I'm really grateful for those guys for taking me under their wings and for the town for still letting me come and go.
Man, that was so nice how you said it. Thank you, man. It was a very cool thing that you shared, and how your way is, I'm like you. I'm really attracted to those people that are like not, you know, sometimes you talk to people and what's their favorite subject? Themselves.
Well, that's a virtue. I don't speak of it like that. You know, I'm really fortunate to be connected to some people who have that.
Right.
I mean, Jimmy jokes all the time that I'm the token Baptist in the Coral Reefer Band. But the whole that ambition to be the guy in the middle of the stage, I was born with zero of that. Yeah. I have none of that at all. And he has enough for four counties.
Right.
And so the fact that I get to stand to his right and draft off of him in the NASCAR sense of drafting on stage and play to 30,000 or 40,000 people, and still in the cracks of his schedule, I get to write the things that fall out of my head and go play. I play 25 or 30 max shows, which are much smaller events, but I get to, if I have something I feel compelled to say myself, I have an avenue to say it. And I get to be of use to my friends in music, as a sideman. And I'm probably more comfortable as far as my nature is that of a sideman. I've had this conversation with Vince Gill over the years. He and I used to sing backgrounds together when I first came to town. And he said when he was a kid, when Elvis was on, he was looking at Scotty Moore. That's right. Who he saw. He didn't see Elvis's hips going every which way. He was looking at Scotty Moore play guitar. When, you know, same Don Rich and Buck Owens, you know, it happens over and over again. There's a sideman that for us sidemen, that's who you gravitate to.
Yeah.
And that's my nature as well. But over the years, I've come to terms with playing a solo show. Now, you know, if there's nobody else on stage, it makes sense to go ahead and do a show, and I'll do that. if there's anybody else there, I'll start backing them up. That's my nature.
That's wild. But isn't it amazing though, like how this not being your nature, how like the forces of the universe just, you know, man, that's what always blows me away when I hear everybody's story.
Well, I joke sometimes, but it's not really a joke that it took like 7 Old Testament miracles daisy chained together to get me a career in the music business, you know, because I honestly never went anywhere and knocked on any door to get to be in a band. You know, this guy came and knocked on our door in Belmont to ask me to play in a band and to pay me good money to do it. The way that I got a record deal, you know, I was playing sessions in Muscle Shoals, and I'm still leapfrogging questions. I apologize.
No, but, man, do it. Keep going.
But we had a session booked at Wishbone Studio in Muscle Shoals, and the artist missed a plane and didn't show up. Our artist, so we had a band and a studio and no artist. And they said, well, shoot, we got a band here. Let's cut a song. Who's got a song? And they, you know, everybody else in the rhythm section had been in the rhythm section longer than me, and they had already cut everything that they had written. And they came to me and they said, "You got anything?" I said, "No, I don't have anything." And they went around about three times. "Oh, surely somebody's got something." "No, I don't have anything." And like after the third time, the engineer, Steve Moore at Wishbone, he points at me and he goes, "I've played in bands with him. I know he's got songs. I know he writes songs. Just, he's bashful. Make him play a song." And I played a song that I'd written when I was 16. I guess I was maybe 18 that when this happened, and called "It's a Crazy World." And they went, "Gosh, we're going to make a record on you. We're just going to make a record on you." And all of a sudden we were cutting tracks on me. Now, I didn't have a record deal. They had to go get a record deal, but I never went anywhere. I'd never even played those songs for my parents. When I got a record deal, I'd never played my songs for my parents. That's just backwards. I'd never performed on stage my own songs. I'd never sung. I'd been a side band in 8 or 10 bands. I'd never even been a guitar player in a band at that point. And I'd been a extremely mediocre piano player up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, they went and got a record deal, and I just sort of recorded that record on a dare. Like, "You guys are crazy, but you know, since nobody else is here, no, there's no artist, I guess we'll cut my song." And that started it.
And that song did very, very well. Why don't you talk about how that song did?
Yeah, it's kind of freaky. My heroes at the time were John Prine, Randy Newman, Ry Cooder, and Buffett, you know, because Jimmy was from Mississippi and had done well. You know, he was a big role model for me as well. And so that's where I wanted to fit in. And they put out "It's a Crazy World" as a single, and it all of a sudden jumped up into charts. You know, what was then the easy listening charts, it went to like number 7, I think, in the easy listening chart, and it was a top 40 pop record. And my buddies, who were all album rock guys, were making fun of me, like, "Man, why did you let it go in the charts?" I don't know. I didn't ask it to go in the charts. It just went there. Nobody told me it was going to. But I might as well have been from Mars. I mean, I'd never flown on planes. I was wearing my grandfather's hand-me-down overalls. I had about 3 pairs of those. That's the only clothes I had.
Wow.
I went to LA, and you know, nobody in my family had even flown on a plane. They broke out into prayer groups at the prospect of me going to LA to sign a record deal. And all of a sudden I'm staying at L'Hermitage. My hotel room came with a Bentley and a driver. It was like the tail end of the disco period, where record labels, you know, would send a limo to pick up the limo driver. That's just
that's, it was so cool. Excess,
late '70s, you know, and I'm sitting out there in a fancy hotel room watching the Beverly Hillbillies and feeling more akin to them than anybody else up and down the hall.
I'm sure, man. I'm totally sure.
But that being said, people were nice to me and they sort of took me under their wings, and I was wide eyed because I'd never really been anywhere. And then all of a sudden I was opening for John Prine, opening for Steve Goodman, opening for Randy Newman, and running the country, Leon Redbone, a bunch of my heroes. I got to open shows and learn from those guys as well. So I've just been so blessed along the way.
Yeah, man. And it, again, to me, I look at that and I'm like, sometimes if you're meant to do something, the world, the universe, whatever you want to call it, is going to get you there, whether you want it or not.
Yeah. You know? Well, I would be a good test case on that one.
Yeah. Sure. No, but I've heard this several times, you know, and it's just, I think when you're doing the right thing, now, if you would have resisted, that would have been a different story. But I think when you're doing something that you're super passionate about, and if it's in the, if that's where you're meant to be, it can't help but happen.
Yeah.
Man. No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, and I'm switching to somebody else from Mississippi as well, but I saw a thing with Bo Diddley about how he got his first record deal, and I'll make it quick, but when he went to Chicago, there was a lady in his apartment building that had a little personal lathe that that you would just use to like record your family history or to read letters that your grandmother wrote or that sort of thing. And he had started writing songs and he said, how does that thing work? And she said, well, you have to have a lacquer, but if you've got a lacquer, you know, you can record your own voice on this machine. He said, well, if I get a lacquer, and he said, I had no idea what a lacquer was, but I said, if I get one, can I sing one of my songs into it? And she said, yeah. But he didn't know what a lacquer was. And he said he was walking one day and somebody had thrown out some old 78 records. It had literally thrown them out. They were in the trash. And he picked up a couple of those and he went to the hardware and he bought some lacquer and poured it over the top of a 78 that was a printed record and just let it congeal and then went and sang his song, which is, I think it was called Uncle John, the song that ended up becoming Hey Bo Diddley. He sang that into just poured lacquer over the top of an old 78 record and took that to Leonard Chess. And Leonard Chess said, well, that's awesome. I'm not going to give you a record deal, but I'll send you to, I forgot where he sent him, but he got a record deal based off of something that totally unscientific, idiotic, no chance on earth that would ever work, except it's Bo Diddley.
Yeah. Wow, man. Thank you. That's a cool story, but that's kind of like your deal, man. I mean, like,
it was very simple. Yeah.
Yeah. What are the chances? You
know, except he's cooler than me. He's Bo Diddley. You know?
As you started moving up, you know, past Mississippi and into your proper career, were your parents always as supportive?
Always.
That's great.
I think they said when I was born, one of my grandmothers said he's got the call to preach. And my other grandmother filed through behind and said, no, he's got the call to preach music. And that's the way they treated me, like I was supposed to be. I mean, Craig, you interview a lot of musicians, I know, and the percentage of musicians that are what their parents wanted them to be is pretty low, you know, but that's what I am. They wanted me to be that more than anything. They wanted me to be a musician, and they probably envisioned me being a music minister at a church.
Right.
But they were just as happy that I was their son playing at the Circle E Club in Iron City, Tennessee, that they would never walk in if you put a gun to their head. But they were happy that I was making a living playing music. And I was at 13 and I turned 63 last month. And, you know, there's been electricity turned on at my house because of music since I was 13 years old.
Right.
You know? And you know, the likelihood of our careers, they're more like professional sports, you know, to have an 8-year career in professional music is really fortunate. That's probably the average.
If you're lucky. Yeah, man.
I still get to do this. And honestly, that's winning the lottery for me. You know, what I was hoping from the beginning is to get to do it again. And I'm still hoping the same thing that I was hoping when I was 13, that I get to do it again.
Well, you still probably make $250 for that same gig 50 years later. That's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, that's inflation.
That's the bad thing.
It's really good pay in 1970.
Man, thank you for sharing all that. That was very cool, man. What were the early, back when you first started your sessions, what were the most important things you learned? I'm sure everything you learned was new, but what were the maybe two or three things you learned that really stayed with you for the last 50 years?
Well, and it's probably typical of guitar players. When a guitar player is playing a guitar, you know, when you're a session musician, you figure out eventually that you're playing songs. It doesn't matter what instrument it is.
Right.
You know, when I went in as a guitar player, I was trying to put a mark on everything. I didn't want to just burn licks all the way, but I was going to pick a spot and show out a little bit somewhere. And it settled in, and the Muscle Shoals guys were great about that because, you know, what's right for this artist and this song is what it is. And you're only incidental to that, you know. It's not every song is not screaming for hot licks from an acoustic guitar player. Right. Yahoo fingerprint, you know, but every once in a while they are. But the guys in Muscle Shoals, they had this wonderful attitude that they didn't see genre. And that was during a time when the record labels really did. They wanted a really hard cookie cutter. Is this pop? Is this rock? Is this country? Is this R&B? and the charts were divided that way, but they didn't look at it that way. They would have Aretha 1 week and they'd go, listen to her. She's amazing. We're going to do the best we can with her. And it'd be Willie Nelson the next week. Hey, check this guy. He's awesome. We're going to do the best we can with that. And they didn't. And Paul Simon the week after that, and then Rod Stewart, and then Cher. And then, you know, it didn't matter who it was. They put their heart into everything that came through. And that's probably still as important as anything I ever learned in a studio, is that whoever it is you're in the service of, whoever is the artist or the label, you're responsible for helping their dream come true. It's their dream. You know, you're lucky that they called you, but what you want is to help them realize their dream. Maybe beyond, you know, it's happened for me a lot of times where what we realized was beyond my dream, you know, but that's bonus.
Yeah.
But from the beginning, I just picked up on that from those guys, and it's still a big part of how I go about my business. And a lot of work that I've gotten over the years as a master session player came from applying those things to demos. Like you got to work. A demo is somebody's dream coming true too. Yeah. You don't have two gears. There's not a demo gear and a master gear. You're always doing your best. If you're the real thing, you're giving them everything you got every time you walk in the door. Everybody is great on a great day. Everybody's good on a good day. Same thing with live performers. Everybody's best show is awesome. It's, you know, how are you on a really bad day when you got a sick relative or a baby home from school, your work, you know, you have to be good that day too. You still got to give it up. And I watched those guys do that without ever saying a thing about it or without ever complaining about it. And that has informed the way that I've carried myself all through from then till hopefully whenever the last one I play.
Yeah. I have found the work ethics of session players, pretty much anybody in the music business who's had a long career, but the work ethic of the session players, they really have, you guys really have service in, you know, you're in the service industry and you're very well aware of it. And I think that makes people so comfortable when they come and hire you, man.
Well, it's a standard line of mine, but in, you know, what I came out of church, so I talk in terms of joyful noise, music yeah, being joyful noise, but music's one of the best things in the world. It's one of the only things in the world that can turn bad into good.
Yeah.
Whatever's the worst day you ever had in your life can turn into a great song that can help somebody else get through the same bad thing that you just went through, and it turns it into a positive thing for both of you. There aren't many things that turn bad into good, and we get to be associated with one of those. And I look at it as almost a responsibility to enjoy music. I honestly believe that joy records just as loud as flat and sharp and rushing and dragging. My favorite records are just pure joy. I mean, my buddy Roger Hawkins played on Chain of Fools for Aretha Franklin. Whatever's the worst day you ever had in your life, if you drop the needle on Chain of Fools, it's about to get a lot better.
Right on, man.
That's just joy. And I've talked to Roger about playing on that record, and he said, well, you know, Aretha, on those sessions, she was sitting there playing that piano live and singing that vocal live right there in the room with us. And I just looked over at her and I said, well, if she's going to do that, I better, by God, do something. and he did. Because Chain of Fools is one grooving son of a gun.
Oh, man. Ain't it really, man? Yeah.
I don't take any credit for being there, but I take credit for appreciating the joy that Roger had from that. And it's evident whether you know about making records, whether you know about sessions, whether you know anything about Aretha Franklin or grooving, period.
Yeah.
You can't help it. You hear that song, you're grooving with it. That's just what it does. It's deep.
I think what you said here, music is joyful noise. And you're right. There is, it's one of the few things that can immediately, which is why people love it, man. It's like it gets you right when you're not sometimes, man. And that's not easy, especially in today's crazy world.
Oh, it's got some healing power. And, you know, just getting to be exposed to good music is a blessing, but getting to play it, in my case, over and over again with people better than me, that's another blessing, because that's the only way to get better, is to be exposed to better than you are. And, you know, I'm in Nashville, so nobody in Nashville is even the best guitar player on their block.
Oh, I know, man. It's crazy.
They've given me 10 of these Musician of the Year awards, and I'm like the third best guitar player in the Coral Reefer block. And I'm not poo-pooing the awards. I'm so grateful for those.
I get it.
Everybody appreciates how I do my business, but I know where I stand. I'm not a fancy guitar player. I'm really an accompanist. And I'm grateful that somebody gives an award for that, you know, because it is the people that do the same job as us that vote on that. So if somebody likes how I do it, I'm grateful.
Man, I think a lot of people like what you're doing. So,
well, thank you.
I want to talk about a few of the people you've worked with and played with. If you could tell me, Mac, how you got the gig, how did it come about, and maybe a funny story or interesting story. I'll start with Jimmy Buffett and the Coral Reefer Band. You probably got a lifetime of stories there, but whatever you do.
we go kind of deep. The same guy that gave me my first record deal, his name is Jay Lasker. He had also been at ABC Dunhill and had given Jimmy his first record deal.
He's a producer in Nashville, right?
No, Jay's he was an old school cigar chomping old school music biz guy.
Okay,
but he had given Jimmy his first deal, and he sent a copy of my first album, which is sort of basically short stories, to Jimmy. He said, "Hey, this kid reminds me of when I signed you, and he's a Mississippi kid, and he's a storyteller." And he just happened to hit Jimmy with that record at a time when Jimmy was stranded, had a gig canceled, and he was stuck in LA for like 3 days. And he rode around and listened to my album and wrote me a little note. And I didn't know anybody in the music business, but I got this little note from Jimmy Buffett that said, "Hey, we're both from Mississippi. We're both storytellers. I like what you're doing. We're going to be friends. I'm going to sing some of your songs. I bet we're going to write songs together." It was the first encouragement from somebody that I looked up to that I got in the music business. And I was 19, and, you know, if you said what percentage of people mean what they're saying in show business, it would not be a very high percentage. But
yes, especially in LA.
if you said nobody, you wouldn't be very far off, you know. But it turns out that Jimmy did. He meant all that stuff, and so that all the things he referred to, plus way more, has transpired in the time since then. The very first time we were in the proximity of one another, we were playing in Philadelphia the same night. He was playing the Spectrum, and I was playing the Bijou opening for Ian Tyson. And he sent for me and brought me to the hotel and introduced me to the rest of what was then the Coral Reefer Band. And then he had me come and sing some backgrounds on a vocal. He cut a song of mine called "It's My Job" on the Coconut Telegraph album. And since then, I've been pretty much working on the records. And I was a studio guy and I had young kids, so he talked about coming out on the road. But I just stopped doing the road while my kids were young and just was a studio guy. And when my kids got up enough to come out in the summertime, he's like, "Hey, come out and I just want you to come out and play a couple acoustic songs with me in the middle of the show. We do a little intermission and play a couple acoustic songs. And your kids can come out. My kids are going to be out too, you know." And I did that early 90s. And except that I didn't ever get off the stage. I played the whole show. And I played the two songs in the middle and the whole rest of the show too, because I like to play.
Yeah.
I pretty much have been there ever since.
Man, every one of your stories is like a heartwarming, man. This is so cool. And I give you a lot of credit for telling them no, that you got to, you know, that you wanted to stay home with your kids, because that's not always an easy decision.
No, and it's not even always an option, you know.
Yeah, right.
And I did, I was fortunate because a lot of that time I was playing guitar on a custom gospel album where you're going to make $200 to cut 10 tracks in a day, you know, and, trying to pay electric bills doing that. And during that time, when my kids were really young, some folks cut some songs of mine that ended up being big hit records and changed the dynamics of and I don't want to say the course of our life, because I'm not really so much a materially based guy, but it made it so that I didn't have to hustle work. I didn't have to consider whether I should be doing a day gig, you know, at the same time. And my now ex-wife, she pointed out a few times that the years that I laid around the house and did nothing, we made more money than when I work. Because I write songs and we own the publishing on those songs. So, you know, when I would go out on the road early on, the years weren't as lucrative as when I was just laying around playing with the kids all day.
Yeah.
And writing songs after they went to sleep at night.
Funny how that turns out, isn't it?
It's very funny how that turns out.
But it's great that you did that. And yeah, I know money doesn't, even if you don't have to be a guy that buys things, it takes pressure off when you can pay your monthly nut, man, and without sweating it, man, for sure. I think everybody's been there, you know?
Oh, and we're probably all have it in front of us too.
That's the way this thing is going.
And I always, you know, looking back now, the uncertainty of being a professional musician, probably prepared us for the way it is for everybody now.
Yeah.
I mean, when I first started playing music as a gig, people talked about, you had a good year, but you need to get a regular job because a regular job's going to be there forever. But regular jobs are not there forever.
No.
You know, there is no 40 years in a gold watch. It doesn't happen anymore. So being ready for the curveball like a musician has to be is probably good prep for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, man. And I hope it changes for everybody.
Oh yeah. So do I. And I never, ever take for granted, all of the good breaks that have had to happen for me to be here talking to you today.
Yeah. But you also made a lot of, you know, the expression you make was luck, and luck is when effort meets preparation or something like that. People sometimes think, oh, he got lucky. He got lucky, but there's a lot of work underneath. You didn't get lucky because you weren't like literally just sitting on the couch. You were writing songs. I mean, you know, it's not like, you know what I'm saying? So you got to like.
No, it's true.
Yeah.
No, when I listen to other people talk about their dues paying, you know, and they tell the horrible gig stories, I pretty much always think, you know, now that they mentioned it, I've got a couple that are at least compete with that, you know, but I don't ever think of it as bad. You know, my dad always told me, that there's only two kinds of days. There's good days and character builders.
That's like the eternal optimist, man. That's awesome.
That's the way he was. I'm sort of a, you know, glass three quarters full guy myself. I have, you know, I can be smarmy about that last empty quarter, but for the most part, I'm trying to find the good in every day. That's what Once in a Lifetime, that's what that song and sort of the core of this record is that, you know, whatever life you have is the best thing you got. And it's an opportunity to enjoy. And I don't see a good reason not to. I can't find a reason not to try to enjoy life and get the best out of it and make something good out of it. And, you know, and if somebody figures out a reason not to, I don't really want to hear it.
Yeah. No, man, I'm totally with you on that, man. You only got one of these lives, you know?
Yep.
And I'm going to ask you about, because I did love the lyrics. I am going to talk about some of the lyrics and tracks, because I noticed that they all had a kind of a common theme. Well, not all, but there was a, you know, a vibe running through them that was pretty consistent. Levon Helm, how'd you connect with Levon?
Well, it was a Muscle Shoals deal. And, you know, he was naturally drawn there as well. And I was honestly just... my connection early on those records was just singing backgrounds. I didn't play. I didn't get to play on the tracks. I would love to. And I got to play live some with him over the years. The Coral Reefers, the last year that he played Newport Folk Festival, we got to do a sort of big jam with him that last year. And that was very special to me because he's just such a soulful guy.
Yeah.
He's a good example of everything I like. And maybe my favorite singing drummer.
Yeah.
In the history of recorded music. And he looked at it like, he actually said it was easier to play drums and sing than not.
Is that how he helped him keep time or something? Or
yeah, he could. I guess, but because his time was so based on melody, he felt it more like an accompanist, I guess, but than just somebody sitting there plowing 1, 2, 3, 4. But he said that it was easier to play drums and sing. And I didn't really get it when at first I heard him say that. But now that I have a little broader picture of it, that's kind of what I do. I'm an accompanist. The job of an acoustic guitar player in the studio a lot of times is to play try to figure out some little signature intro and then get you to the chorus.
Right.
I'm playing kind of what the singer would be playing if the singer was playing the guitar. Up until the full band comes in at the chorus. So you have to be conscious of the melody. You have to be conscious of some counterpoint running around the melody, making space for the melody, and then, moving a little bit in the cracks between the melody. And I see now how that informed his drumming. But I didn't see it. The first time I heard him say that, it didn't make sense to me. It makes more sense to me now. But so I don't want to pretend to have had a long career with Levon, but being able to work on those records and then be around him a little bit at the end were both wonderful things.
That's cool, man. Roy Orbison.
Wow. Well, he was the first time I heard in the studio that kind of a singer. And when I say that kind, that I'm talking about maybe a handful.
Yeah.
He was that kind of a singer. And just the sweetest, very humble, very much in common the way he grew up and the way I grew up. We naturally hit it off. And he immediately sort of took me under his wing. And he actually had me go out. I opened a run of shows for Roy.
Oh, man.
Just
from cool.
Playing acoustic guitar on his record. He just thought I was funny, and and so I got to go out there and it's the first time I ever saw watching him live was the first time I ever saw a note get a standing ovation.
Wow!
Every night, it happened every night. But that sort of big note in Only the Lonely, people would just be sitting there and he would hit. And all of a sudden they would come up out of their chair and be they didn't even know they were going to do a standing ovation. They just were all of a sudden standing up clapping for a note, And I was aware that I was not ever going to really be a singer.
Man, you have a great, your voice is killer. Are you kidding me, man? You have incredible. Don't even, you could be as humble as you want, man. Your voice is awesome. I mean, as a singer, as a speaker, please, man, it really, I'm not just blowing smoke up your butt either, man.
But at any rate, Roy was a big deal to me because I had not heard somebody with just that kind of a natural gift at that time. Later on, I've gotten to play with some of the best singers. I got to play with Ray Charles, and I've gotten to play with Willie. George Jones, unbelievable singer. George Strait, unbelievable singer. There's bunches of them. Trisha Yearwood, Keith Whitley, all those yeah. Keith Whitley, the classic Keith Whitleys, those are mostly live vocals of him just sitting in the room with us. When the track went down, it sounded exactly like the record minus the backgrounds. Wow. Everything was live. That's pretty special, and so I've been really fortunate that way. Hank Williams Jr. On Family Tradition, that was a very early session for me, but Hank and they brought that song out and he said, now when it gets to that, why do you drink? I said, I want everybody just to reach down and yell into their instrument mics in the studio. So I'm sitting there and the drummer's yelling on the, you know, everybody that's playing, why do you drink? Why do you roll smoke into our instrument mics? I think I was 18. I was like, is this how they do that? And I've actually never, ever done that again in my life from then to now. But it's one of the biggest records I ever played on. And our drummer, Roger Clark, on that record couldn't sing a note with a gun to his head. But he's singing all over Family Tradition. Just caterwauling. Why do you drink? but you listen to that record, and it's got all that energy, to it because it was live and something different than we'd ever done.
Yeah. Hey, this is a tough question, but tell me, knee-jerk reaction, top three session experiences for you. Could be just the vibe, anything you want.
You know, I've got so many, I can't not include Keith Whitley in the live, that stuff, I'll just say maybe No Stranger to the Rain, because I got to play that cool intro lick and felt kind of important. I played the little turnaround in Don't Close Your Eyes, and all of those were live. I wanted to redo it because I didn't think my guitar was all the way in tune, and I went, oh no, man, that's exactly what it needs to be. And his vocal was exactly what it needs to be. It was just a live record. I'm just riffing, but when we did George Strait, Give It Away, when they pulled that song out, another one, they asked me to come up with an intro, and I fortunately did. I don't always get it, but I came up with kind of a cool lick at the top of the song, but I remember thinking from the first time they played that song, this is a song of the year. I'm about to get to play on a song of the year.
Really? You knew it was that good?
Yeah. Yeah. Jamie Johnson and Buddy Cannon and Bill Anderson, which is, that's a great inspiration too. When you think about what we were talking about, length of musical careers, Bill, in his way up in his 70s, writing a song of the year. And he had two of them. He had Whiskey Lullaby and he wrote Give It Away in his late 70s. Tony Brown used to joke about Bill that he sang his way out of the music business and he wrote his way back in.
That's a good line.
But Bill's awesome. He's an awesome singer too. But the fact that, that he's still got relevant stuff to offer over all those decades is an inspiration, because I'm just one decade away from that now. I'm hoping there might be something in there for me too.
I hear you, man. So Keith, George Strait, what would be number three? And I realize it may not be, it just whatever comes to mind.
It's what pops to you, I guess, at the time. Well, it's another moment. We were doing the License to Chill album on Buffett. We were in Key West at Jimmy's studio, and it was one of those not a compilation, but guest singers. Everybody was coming. We had Toby and Alan Jackson and George and Chesney and Clint Black and various people were all just sort of filing through. It was going, and I'm a producer on that record. I'm in what we call the produce section. I'm responsible for the record to the label and everything. But you never know how those things are going to go. And Jimmy's he wants to have a good time every day. And we started, we cut a couple of tracks and we're like, man, this is pretty good. And a week can go different according to how every little thing happens. That, the dominoes either fall good or they fall bad. And what started our dominoes falling was we cut a track of Hey Good Looking. And we said, all these guests are coming in. We'll just have everybody sing a pass of Hey Good Looking and we'll sort of make it an all skate. We'll use a couple of Chesney lines and a couple of, we'll let everybody sing it and then we'll put it together at the end. And the first guy that came through was George Strait. And he brought his boat down to Key West and he got off his 96 foot fishing boat. And and Jimmy's studio is literally two steps out of the water.
Wow.
In the harbor at Key West. So George walks in and we just cut a couple of tracks. It was the beginning of the week. We had Bill Payne from Little Feet and Sonny Landreth was in there playing guitar. We had an awesome band.
Yeah.
And the core, they were, you know, supplemented gunslingers into the Coral Reef band. And so we just cut this track of Hey Good Looking. Nobody had sung it yet. And George came in and sang the living dog shit out of it. I mean, just unbelievable vocal. Just walked in and sang it. And because he did that, because he walked straight in out of his boat and killed it, it raised the level of every track that we cut on the rest of that album. It raised the level of every vocal that got sung on that record got better because of what George did in 5 minutes after he came. And it's just one of those, you know, somebody elevates and it's a reminder how much it matters to do your best.
Yeah.
You know, because sometimes singers come in the studio and they go, oh yeah, I'll just throw a pile of vocal down for you. And, you know, and we'll come back and work on it. But that affects how we play. It affects how everything that happens on the, you know, everything's a performance. Music is listening and George brought it. And even if I didn't get a chance to learn that and apply it to everything else I ever do, which I did, even if I'd just been there for that little magic moment, it would still be a magic moment that I would never forget in my life.
That's so cool, man. You know, I live in Tampa, but we lived in South Florida for a long time. The Keys have changed a lot over the last 25 years, haven't they, man?
Oh yeah, it's a lot different. A lot different, but it's still the Keys.
Yeah. It's dramatically different, man.
Oh, it is. There's no question. From the time, you know, Jimmy went down there because Jerry Jeff told him to.
He said,
man, I think your deal's going to be down there. I think you're going to find some little saltwater deal down there that's going to be your deal. And it was. You know, Jimmy's he's a grandson of a shipbuilder, you know, so that access to saltwater is a big deal for him. But that was sort of the last ingredient to his recipe.
So that song, Son of a Sailor, that's legit.
He's not kidding.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I didn't know that. Thank you, man.
He's got a really good imagination, but it wasn't necessary for that
one. Yeah. Man, tell me about maybe some of the low points or dark periods you've had to deal with in life, and how'd you get through them, Mac?
Well, I'll start with a Buffett one. We cut this Mark Knopfler awesome song called La Di Da. We cut on a Jimmy, and it's a kind of a dark, sad song. And Jimmy sang a great vocal on it. And he's walking out of the studio at the end of the day, and I said, "Man, that's a really good vocal, Jimmy." And he doesn't think of himself as much of a singer. He said, "Well, thank you." I said, "And that's a deep, sad song." I said, "You did a good job of drawing on the three bad days you've had in your whole life." And Jimmy looked up and goes, "Yeah, it is about three. That's about that. You know, he's had a lot of dreams come true, and his bucket list is." Been emptied out and refilled three or four times, and all of those have already come true too. But
good for him.
But and for me, I've been pretty good at finding the silver lining in most of my bad days. But probably, you know, losing my dad, he died young. The men in my family die young.
Sorry, man.
And I stopped eating and it was music and my first child that brought me out of that. I think the two of those things combined, and that's going to be a recurring story for me. You know, 3 years ago, I was turning 60 and I was feeling a little funny about having my dad died at 58. He had seven brothers. Only one of them made it to 65.
Wow.
And so I'm thinking, you know, I'm at the short end of a fuse here, and I went and had all these tests run, and they said, well, you know, you're fine. And so then I just booked a bunch of work. They said you're healthy as a horse, and I booked a bunch of work, and I was working hard, but I still didn't really feel good. And I ended up having, across a weekend, I had what they said was four heart attacks. The last one, first three, I just kept working through, but the last one was the Widowmaker deal, and I was supposed to not be here, but I called 911 and they came and saved my life and put some stents in my heart. And I'm in today, as we talk, I'm in what I call the bonus round.
Yeah, man. Wow.
And if I died at 60, I've had a wonderful life and wouldn't change anything about it. But, I had no cholesterol, no high blood pressure, none of this indicators, no sugar, no diabetes, no sign of anything, but I was 100% blocked in the Widowmaker artery and 99% blocked in the arth, just DNA, it was just male DNA of the McAnally.
Yeah.
but I'm still here. As long as I'm still here, I'm going to talk about every day being once in a lifetime, because it really is.
Thank you, man. Now I'm getting the whole picture of that record. Wow. Holy smokes, man. Thank you for, it's interesting. Our kids are probably close. My older ones are 28 and 30. Yours are probably maybe the same.
My youngest is 30 and I got 30 through 38. Yeah. And three girls.
You're such a good guy. What did you do bad to get three girls? That ain't easy raising three girls, man. I had one. It took everything out of me. But there, my son.
A couple of decades where you don't know anything. Daddy knows nothing.
Yeah, of course. My sons are at the age now where they're concerned. And they have no reasons to be concerned, but it's interesting. I'm happy they're concerned, but they're like concerned about me now, which is
right.
Well,
I've got, and it's a pandemic, I'm high risk at this point with a damaged heart and it's working, but it's damaged, So I've got to be more careful, and I get plenty of advice about being more careful from my three girls, and I try to take it as much as I can.
Yeah, man. Well, I hope everything is okay. And thank you for sharing. I'm glad you're okay, man.
Oh yeah, no, I'm proud to be here, and grateful for whatever. Whenever it shuts down, it's been great.
Any advice that you would give yourself? Go back if you can give you that would make your life easier.
Well, maybe learn to read a contract, but
I can't say that I haven't heard that before.
But the fact of the matter is, Craig, they don't make a contract that we wouldn't sign.
Yeah.
It's the business of our dreams coming true. There's nothing that we wouldn't sign. Oh, if I sign this, I get to make a record. If I don't, okay, give me a pencil.
And that is the unfairness of this, because people look at that and they leverage that, man, and that's not cool. Fair should be fair.
It's true. It's true.
I've heard so many stories of this, and yeah. I've heard some stories. I had Mark Farnham from Grand Funk Railroad, man. They talk about railroaded, man. That they got totally railroaded, man. It was just amazing what that's what happens. You get some 20-year-old kids in there and say, hey, man, I know you want to make a record. Let's do this.
You're going to get to.
Yeah, you're going to get to. Just sign this. I know. It's terrible, man.
Now, there was a Freddie Fender record that got made in Muscle Shoals, and I think it was like his 30-something album, and he did all those records with Huey Moe, who was sort of notoriously terrible contracts back in the day. And they pulled up, and Freddie came into the rhythm section sitting there and said, guys, I thought we were going to make a record, but we're not going to get to. And they went, what do you mean? We got studio, we got a band, you're here, we'll make a record. He goes, well, I went to everybody where I usually borrow money, and nobody would loan it to me, and I can't pay for the record. And the guys were like, man, it's Mercury. We got PO numbers. Everything's good to go. We can make a record. It's all good. And Freddie goes, wait a minute. The record label pays for the sessions?
Oh my God.
And it was like his 34th album that he'd ever made, and he'd gone and borrowed money. To make those records. And
that is sickening. Man, that's really sickening to hear that.
It is. And I don't have anything at that level. And whatever my worst thing is, Greg, and there's a bunch. I mean, my actual recording contract is on the wall for several lawyers saying this is what could happen.
Oh, man.
That being said, if I hadn't signed the worst deal that I ever signed, I wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
If I had, I'll take it.
Yeah, I get it.
I've had so much good that's beyond what I deserve. I'll take the things that were bad more than I deserve too. I'll take it all together.
I think everybody's like that in life. If you're basically a happy person where you're at, I mean, you don't go 50, 60 years without getting burnt. That's not possible. No. And I think everybody pretty much, you're happy. You're like, you know what? Shit happens and whatever. You know, I'm here. I'm happy. Everything's cool.
It's all part of how you got where you are.
Yeah. Yeah. But that was funny what you said that though. I learned how to read a record. Man, I want to talk about some tracks from the new record, Once in a Lifetime.
Awesome.
First Sign of Trouble, man, that was a very fun song. The lyrical play on words reminded me a little of Jerry Reed on some of his stuff that he would do. It was really great picking throughout the song. But you had some pretty deep lyrics. I fear for the future and I'm petrified of the past. What's the backstory to that?
Oh, it's, you know, I went into character with that whole song. It's sort of like a talking blues a little bit, you know, and Jerry was a super, I got to play on some Jerry records too. And he was a hero of mine. One of the best finger pickers ever.
Oh yeah.
I was honestly embarrassed to pick up a guitar next to Jerry, but I got to, and he was, couldn't have been more gracious, but I'm not in any way a blues singer, but I have, there's some soulful aspect of what I do that comes from the years in Muscle Shoals. And that whole sort of just putting myself, that's in character.
Okay.
That's a character singing that song as opposed to me.
And yeah. You know,
I'm probably a little bit afraid of everything, but I'm not as afraid of everything as that guy is singing the song. He's exaggerated. He's a caricature of whatever is chicken about me. But it's just, it is joyful noise. It's extremely lighthearted and darting around, you know, even in the chorus, you know, I joke about knock, knock jokes and all. Yep. There's a bunch of right and left turns lyrically in that song that are just sort of brain tickles to me. That's my terminology. I don't know if that's a good one or not.
That's a perfect description, man. And because they all made me smile, every one of them. I listened to the record 2 or 3 times, and it was like it was really cool. It was really humorous, man. It was very brain tickles. A great word.
Well, that's what I had, anyways. Yeah, but it's fun to play. It is a fun one to play. I'm going to have to actually work it up for the show because I haven't really performed it, you know. And it is kind of a handful to sing and play at the same time. But
there's some tough picking in there, man.
But I look forward to it. Look forward to pulling that out at the show.
Good guys win. Good guys win every once in a while. Anything in particular you're thinking about when you wrote that?
Well, it was, it was a song that was written. We did some music for a movie called Hoot that Jimmy was involved in. Our friend Carl Hyacin wrote the novel.
Oh yeah, from the Miami, the novel writer from Miami. Yeah, right, yeah, great writer. Yeah,
and a newspaper columnist as well. Carl's awesome. But it was sort of a kid's story about sort of, it's an environmental story that, and Jimmy's big, you know, a big environmentalist, coming from where he comes from down there too. But we did some soundtrack work on that, and we wrote that song, as the song at the end of the movie. And our drummer, Roger Guth, and I wrote it. And honestly, because it was kind of an assignment, I never really assessed whether it was that good of a song or not, because it, you know, it served our purpose.
Sure.
And I didn't record it. Jimmy sang it on the movie. And, but then when we had the premiere, everybody that was involved in the record came to the premiere, and Bill Withers, fortunately, was one of the guys who did a song for that soundtrack. And he's worked, Bill and I got to be friends as well. Same, just like Roy, Bill came from a farm, West Virginia. He was super humble.
A strange name of a town of where he was born, if I remember correctly. I remember
the name of his hometown, but you're right.
Yeah.
But like really rural, probably he was more of a farm kid than me. But we had that same humble, and when we screened the movie for everybody that was involved in it, even before the premiere, and Bill stood up, he's after the end of the movie, he said, "What in the hell is that song? That's an awesome song." And we had never really, we'd just sort of written something that hopefully everybody was okay with. And then he started bragging on it. I was like, you know, that is kind of a good song. You know, it applied to the film, but if you just take it as on its own merit, it still has some good stuff to say.
Really cool song, man.
One of my best friends brought it up at a couple of shows last year, said, you've never played Good Guys Win. You've never played that live. You've never sung it. I was like, no, I haven't. He said, that's really a good song. And so a couple of the tracks on the record, that one and the song Changing Channels, which is like the second thing Jimmy and I ever wrote together, came as a result of people coming to my show and saying, why don't you ever sing that song? That's an awesome song. And, you know, because it had been already a Buffett cut, I figured, well, who needs a Mac cut? There's already a Buffett cut of that song. But folks kept asking, and in some cases they'd come up and say, which one of your records at the end of the show, you know, you have CDs out there at merch.
Sure.
One of these has Changing Channels and Good Guys Win, you know, none of them.
Oh.
Well, then you should cut it, you know. So a couple of the tracks on the record came from that. Those two songs particularly came from that. And I'm really grateful that we did cut it.
Yeah, they're great. And so you basically wrote this as a licensed track.
Well, I recorded a new track for it, but yeah.
Originally.
Song, yeah, it was written for the film. And
wow.
It was the song at the end of the movie, and Jimmy sang it. And he acted in the movie. He was, I think he was a science teacher.
Very
in the film.
Hoot.
Yep.
And, man, The Better Part of Living, that is a really pretty song, man. And, I mean, it's really nice. And it sounds like you're kind of maybe lamenting something there. And I was curious because you say stuff like too much talking, not enough giving, too much talk and not much to say.
Well, you know, it's sort of a bunch of, it's a few of my dad's sayings and probably a few of them that I've, cooked down to a reduction sauce in the time since he's been gone. But, you know, I was really grateful to grow up at the foot of one of the finest men I've ever known and not anybody like anybody else that I've ever known. He was the most selfless guy. He was sort of a Gandhi-like guy. And I miss him. You know, I miss knowing somebody else like that. And I aspire to be a watered down version of him, you know, and if at the end of my life, somebody says he's a watered down version of his dad, I'm going to take that as a compliment, a big compliment.
Yeah.
And I'm just reminding myself, you know, that a lot of times the things that we measure life by are not really the things that it's best measured by. Of course, the better part of living can't be measured out in pay.
Yeah.
You know, that's true. You know, the guy with the most toys wins that game. But I know some really happy people that are just happy because they helped somebody else along.
Yeah.
On a given day. And that's an easier thing to control. You know, If you can figure out a way to enjoy your life, make somebody else's better, and do those two things that are not at the direct expense of another person or somebody else or some group of people, then you won. You know,
this is a very timely song for the insanity of the world today, man. To be honest with you,
John Prine wrote Crooked Piece of Time. And this crooked piece of time got John, and he's one of my heroes. But he wrote Crooked Piece of Time ahead of its time. This is probably what he was talking about, what we got right now. But you know, there's never been a time that music didn't make better.
And yeah.
I'm just happy to still be here trying.
Great record, man. I was really pleased to listen to it and really happy to get to connect with you here. Is there anything you haven't done yet musically that you'd like to do? Now's our chance to put it out into the universe, man, right here.
I have to say, you know, my dreams were modest, and, you know, I've gotten to play with Ray Charles and Paul McCartney and, you know, so way outside of, I feel, I would feel guilty about asking for anything more. But yes, there's more I want to do. Yeah.
Yeah, man. What?
Well, and I got to make a record standing in front of an orchestra of my music too. That's pretty unbelievable.
That is very cool.
But it's just basic. It's the same thing I wanted when I was 13 at the Circle E Club. I want to do it some more. I want to get better. It's not one thing. It's not that I want to play Carnegie Hall. There aren't physics attached to it. I want to get better. I want to do it better than I've done it so far. And I want to do it again. That's really it.
That's awesome, man. Let's shift for a few minutes. I want to talk about gear. What's your go-to guitar right now, and what other two would round out your top three?
Well, I'm primarily a finger picker, and I've accumulated a few guitars. I'm not really a collector, but I've got a bunch of them that I use for specific tools. But the one I'm picking up and playing all the time right now is one of those Sinker Martins, the ancient mahogany that was at the bottom of the river for 100 years, and it was, you know, maybe 150 or 200 years old when it sank to the bottom of the river. So it's 200 or 300 year old mahogany, and it's a brand new guitar. It's a quad 018 Martin, and it's just humongous. It's not a giant guitar, but it sounds gigantic. And I've got this baritone voice, so I need some low end.
Yeah.
As a solo instrumentalist, I need a guitar that can get down around my unnecessarily large voice coming out of an unnecessarily large head. That's kind of main one for me here lately. But I got to have some Gibsons with dead strings on them for recording. I love that. That's my favorite rock and roll rhythm is an old Gibson with dead strings on it. And then beyond that, and not because of the guitar, although it's an amazing guitar, but I've got an Olson that was the main writing guitar of my dear departed friend, Robert Byrne. I've got maybe three old buddies that are not with me anymore, and I have their main writing guitar. And
that's pretty cool.
It's my way of keeping them in it, keeping them in the game. They go out on the road with me. They still write songs with me. And it makes me try hard in the same way that we tried hard when we were knocking heads in the same room trying to write songs 35 years ago. So it's good for me, and it helps keep their name out there a little bit as well, because I give them credit on stage. I'm like, this is my buddy Robert Byrne, and I play Two Dozen Roses that he and I wrote together for Shenandoah. I pull his guitar out and give him some credit.
That's cool, man.
And that's what it is. So I love, you know, I just love guitars. So it's not necessary that I have one in particular, but I try to find some magic in all of them. A lot of them seem like they have songs. That one does.
What was the electric you played on the record on Once in a Lifetime? I don't remember which song it was, but you just tore it up towards the end of the, it might've been on The Better Part of Living. It sounded,
you know, great. All of that overdubbing was done pandemic time. I think there is some running around at the end of Better Part of Living. That's a Les Paul. That's an old black Les Paul. Not a, you know, particularly vintage, but it's a good Les Paul.
What do you play through amp wise in the studio?
You know, Chet, and I'm not really an electric player, but Chet turned me on to these little RD 50 watt Music Man's, small little I've got a 10 and a 12 of those, and they're just all mid-range, but when, you know, when you got a full track and you cut a really mid-rangey amp, and I've got a little Tweed Deluxe that I still use sometimes too, but those Music Man, for some reason or other, you can pull the fader almost all the way down and still hear them just loud as all. They're just, hey, listen to me, you know. Those guitars, those amps have what I don't have as a guy, and I like that about them. And I got to give Chet some credit for turning me on to them.
Tough question. Top three Desert Island discs.
Well,
just for now, man, because this, you know, this could change.
All right. 20 minutes. I'm there. Abbey Road's always going to be one of them because of the studio aspect of it. Right. And when I was trying to learn how to make arrangements and the beginning of learning how to record, I just was sitting at the house in Mississippi with a little terrible stereo, but I would unplug the left speaker and listen to the right side of Abbey Road five times in a row. And then I would listen to the left side five times in a row. I was trying to hear what was going on, how they put it together. And so that's always going to be one for me. And maybe Randy Newman, Good Old Boys, just because the concept album aspect of things. And the first John Prine. Can't beat the first album of John Prine's. Those songs will stand up any generation. Anybody from the United States of America that ever hears John Prine's first album is going to know what's going on.
Right on, man. Three good records. Hey, tell me the what makes you happy, man?
Friends and family and music and food. You can have everything else. You can have everything else.
That's good, man. Friends, family, music, and food.
Yeah, there's three F's.
Are you do you eat a lot of Southern food being from the Deep South, or do you eat healthy now?
A lot of Southern food is in my history. It's a treat for me now.
Yeah,
I can't do the regular diet that we used to do. But like I said, I never had the cholesterol stuff. But since I've got heart damage, I'm more conscious of it. And I've got three kids that are sort of wanting me to hang around.
Yeah, know? Man, of course, hell yeah.
So I eat a lot healthier than I used to, but I do love food and the Coral Reefers. You know, we tour the same cities most every year, and we know where we're going, and we know what we're going to have. It's, you know, you heard the old joke about when in Rome, we're always in Rome.
Yeah, that's cool, man.
You know, so you got to be careful, or you're going to weigh 400 pounds if you're always in Rome. And so I've learned to govern myself a little bit.
Tell me, this is a real tough question. What do you like most about yourself?
Oh, I'm not my biggest fan, to be honest with you, but I believe me, you know, I'm not a fan of my voice, but when that guy sings, I believe, and I know I'm generally writing something that I've drawn some conclusion I've drawn from living, that I believe. And I like that about it. I just looked up at the time. I'm going to have to go and do another one here in a sec, but I'll punctuate that with a story from when I was a kid, if it's all right.
Yeah, man, please do.
You remember the thing when we were growing up, they talked about George Washington, I cannot tell a lie, cut down the cherry tree, which they now say is a totally fabricated story. I mean, but whoever told me that, yeah. It was early fake news. But that hit me really hard. So I was just, as a kid, I was just rigid. I will not tell a lie. And I've learned to stretch the truth since then as a songwriter, but as a kid, it was rigid. I would not tell a lie. And we were poor kids in Mississippi, poor family. My grandfather always carried a $50 bill. He had a $50 bill in his wallet that, as far as I know, he never spent. He always had it, but he counted himself rich because he had this $50 bill. He used to do a trick with me, and he would say, watch this. And he said, Lil Mac. I go, yeah. He said, you want my $50 bill? Yes, Grandpa, I do. He said, well, I will give you my $50 bill if you can run around the house three times and not think about possums. I was like, okay. And I would get down in a three-point football stance, and he would say, ready, set, go. And I would run about three steps, and I'd go, I thought about him. The fact that I wouldn't lie to him about not thinking about possums, I thought he was proud of me, but he actually thought I was an idiot because I wouldn't lie for $50. that was like winning the lottery to us at that time.
Yeah.
He probably did that to me 100 times, and I only got around the first corner one time before I admitted that I had thought about possums. There's no real moral to that story, but there is something connection between that. It was important to me to be truthful then, and it's important to me to be truthful now. It's a different piece of time. I'm a writer now, and I realize it. And there is one of my favorite Mark Twain's somebody busted Mark Twain about this thing you said in your book is not true. And he said, that's correct. It's not true. It is not the job of a writer to tell the truth. It is the job of a writer to lie in such a way as to reveal the truth better than the actual truth itself.
And that is the truth.
That is the truth. And you know, if I get it right, I do that every once in a while. And I'm going to keep trying to do it a couple more times.
Well, man, I believe you as well. And I know loads of people believe you. Whatever you're doing is working, man. It's like magic. And I can't thank you enough for everything you've done musically and for all your time and your sincerity, man. I really appreciate it. And I mean it. Let me tell people quick where to find you. Please check out Mac's new record. It's called Once in a Lifetime. He's got a massive catalog. He's got a really good, a robust website. It's at Mac McAnally, and his last name is spelled McAnally. So it's MacAnally.com. He's also on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. He's probably like a new social media maven that you don't know about.
I'm learning this stuff as you're quoting it. I need to write it down.
I need to write it down. All under Mac McAnally. Man, I can't thank you enough for everything. Thank you so much for time. Let me wrap this up and then I'll say goodbye to you. Anything else that I forgot to say or promote?
No, I'm proud to be here and I'm grateful to your help because I'm clearly not the best self-promoter and you're helping us out. We thank you very much.
Man, you can come on this show and I'll promote you anytime, honestly.
Thanks, bro.
Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels with your friends. We appreciate it. Thanks very much to Mac McAnally. Please check out his new record and go to his website, MacMcAnally.com. And most important, man, especially nowadays, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I am out. Thank you so much, brother. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Everyone Loves Guitar. If you did, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the audio podcast and to our very active YouTube community. And if you have any comments, please write me at everyonelovesguitar.com/hello. We'll see you on the next episode. Until then, make sure you choose happiness. Relax and have as much fun as possible.